Hi, I'm Jerome Davis. I'm the artistic director of Burning Coal Theater Company. Welcome to Into the Fire, the Burning Coal Theater Company podcast series that we're doing this year on all things theater and hopefully a few subjects beyond. Today's guest is one of the most esteemed members of the theater community in Raleigh, North Carolina. His name is Roy C. Dix, and he is at this point the lead theater critic for the News and Observer. Roy, welcome.
Thanks a lot.
It's great to have you here. Everybody in the theater community, and I imagine most of the people who are fans of this art form and other art forms as well in the Triangle know your name, but I'm not sure how many people know you. Can you tell us just a little bit about who you are, where you're originally from, and how you got interested in this art form?
Sure. I'm a North Carolina native, born in Fayetteville. I went to East Carolina University for my undergraduate degrees, and I was already interested in theater and had been participating in theater in Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. And so I got a theater degree and an English degree from East Carolina. I knew at the time that I was not going to make my living at theater, which, as you know, is a difficult thing.
Yes.
But I was so enamored of it and enjoyed it so much, I wanted to continue in whatever capacity I could. So after I graduated and settled in Raleigh, because there were jobs, and I got a job as a librarian with the Wake County Public Libraries, which became my long-term 27-year career, because I went on to get a master's degree in library science from UNC Chapel Hill. So that was my day job, as they call it. But I was participating in actively in theater for 20 years, including...
In what capacity?
As an actor first. I was in about 65 productions over 20 years. Yes. Then luckily was able to turn into a director, because Tom Dawson, another actor here, and I started Raleigh Ensemble Players.
Mm-hmm. And that was in 1978, 77?
No, let's see, 82 is our sort of official... And so I was there for 10 years as both director for some of the productions, as well as co-manager and later only manager, up until we got to be so large that I couldn't do that and still keep a day job. So I went on to where they had full-time people hired for that. So so I directed for about 10 years and also directed many other places in the Triangle. So I did about 30-odd shows in those 10 years as a director. And then, with a short hiatus of a few years, when I was nearing the ability to retire from my day job at the library, the News Observer called me and said they wanted me to start, what would I be interested in doing criticism? It actually started as music and then dance and went into theater after Bill Morrison, who was there forever,
yes,
was a great reviewer, left. So then I've been reviewing theater for the News Observer since 2000.
So good. That's great. Tell me a little bit about the work in the library. Were you managing the library system in Wake County?
Not at the top level. In fact, my interest was from in the reference area. So I was a reference librarian for most of that time. Sometimes I was the head of a branch. Sometimes I was head of a department. They had different things. The neat thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that I was in a lot of different positions, not because I had done something wrong, but because they needed somebody to either start a program or head a new branch or head a new reference service. And so that gave me a lot of variety, and I enjoyed that. So the last thing I ended up doing before I left was, at that time, heading up the new thing, which was what they called the electronic information branch, because it was at the beginning of the internet era for information.
Well, I was going to say, during that stretch of time, you would have seen a profound change in the way libraries function and the way, the degree to which people use them. Can you comment on that? Do you see libraries in our future?
It's an interesting thing. I do, indeed. And as you may have read recently, it seems like the circle is coming back around now, because the things like ebooks have gone down in the number of purchases and usage, and books have never really gone away. And so the great thing is that all those things that I trained for and learned about how you find information using traditional sources and a few that were electronic as the time went on, completely changed right as I was leaving. And it was exciting to me, because it was, in my mind, wow, look at this great new way to get information bigger, better, faster, and all of that. Right. But it did for a while make it look like, oh, well, we won't need libraries now because everybody can just get online. As we know, mm-hmm. that doesn't really work. And the thing that libraries are still there for is to guide people mm-hmm. to the right information or to the best way to get the information. And reading for pleasure is still there. Mm-hmm. And people, it turns out, still prefer to hold the book.
I completely agree.
They had to change some things about what they serve, but I think they're serving more than ever, especially for people who can't just up and decide, I'm going to buy a computer and pay for the service and have access to all this. It does, it still costs money, and that's a factor.
There have been moments when I'm lugging an 800-page book through the airport or something like that, when I think, boy, I wish I had one of those little electronic gadgets to read this on, but mostly I don't. Mostly I feel like the tactile relationship between the reader and the book, the physical relationship, has something to do with learning the information that's in the book.
I think that's true. A lot of people I talk to about that, about bemoaning if we thought the book was going away at the time, and saying, I just love holding the book. There's something about the connection to it and the ability to kind of turn as you will. There's still some things about it that are easier than, even though it's all there on the screen, you've got to do a lot of back and forth and clicking and finding the page, whereas if you want to flip to the index of the book, there it is.
You just do it. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Fascinating. I didn't know about that part of your life. So schooling for you was ECU and then
UNC for
UNC
the master's.
For the graduate, influences in your life, are artists who influenced you or personal influences?
Well, it might not be something that everybody knows, but the story I always tell about going to East Carolina and getting the theater degree there is that I was from Fayetteville. I did participate in theater, but it was, small town at that time, and I did not have a lot of outside experience. I hadn't traveled much. I was all, insular in that way. And when I went to East Carolina, they had these wonderful teachers who had all done professional work. Mm-hmm. I mean, big time Broadway and running theaters, but they had come there to start a program in the 60s. And so I knew they were good, and I knew I was getting what I could see was really great training, but it still had this feeling to me that, well, I'm just here at East Carolina in Greenville in the, eastern North Carolina, and so I can't wait to get out into the big real world and see the real, true theater. Yeah. And I say that because once I did that, I realized, my gosh, it's almost the same. I mean, it really was such great training, and Edgar Lacine was the head of that program, and he was a wonderful directing teacher. Mavis Ray was a great choreography and movement teacher. There were many, many teachers that were just so good, and I realized only when I got out and started doing more, certainly in the Triangle, that I had wonderful training and that what I was seeing was, no better than what I had already experienced. So that gave me confidence to kind of work. And I drew a lot of my ability, if you want to call that, to do the theater criticism because of that training, and it was solid, and I still to this day recall things that I say, why is that director doing that? And don't they realize this? And it's all coming from.
Didn't they listen in class?
That's right. Isn't this 101 directing or acting? But anyway, so I certainly give them credit. And I'll give credit to two directors early on in my acting and then later directing career, if that's the right word. David Wood at Theater in the Park.
Sure.
He can be controversial, but he is a solid theater person, and he gave me so many pointers about acting specifically, and would be very firm in trying to get more out, and so I credit him with giving me a lot of feeling for what makes theater and how you have to push for things. And also Harry Callahan, who was at St. Mary's. He was at Broadville Theater earlier, but at St. Mary's he turned this what you would call a small women's two-year college at that point, into this theatrical wonder, because he would put on things like Candide and Follies and just Sweeney Todd. And I was in all those, and just amazing. Anyway, but his what he showed me was that you can do so much with so little. Yeah. You don't need to have those huge, seemingly huge productions. Right. Came off very well, and it was because he knew how to find the core of that without all the trappings. So I give those two certainly a lot of credit for giving me more than what I had gotten at East Carolina.
Harry was before my time here in this area, but I still hear about him to this day. So he apparently, his influence was considerable. Your point about the value of audiences, respective of their zip code, is I think a profound one, and one that continues to be sort of drilled into the heads of young people across our country, that you're not doing important work unless you're doing it in the Manhattan zip codes, and it's a brand. You know, New York City, for better or for worse, is a brand, and they protect it in that way. One example of that is in the political arena right now. We never hear the national media, which is based in New York City, refer to Donald Trump as the New York City based billionaire. They never refer to him as that, and that's because they're protecting their brand against someone who may or may not be the next Hitler. So I think your point is very well taken there. When I think of early REP, and I wasn't around in its formative years, but I think of writers like Sam Shepard, Lanford Wilson, American writers from the mid part of the 20th century. Was that your and Tom's vision for that theater?
Well, certainly that was a core part of it, but the real vision was before we started that, all through the 70s and early 80s, when I was active as an actor and many others, you know, obviously in the Triangle, and certainly concentrated in Raleigh for our particular purposes, we all hungered for the ability to act in plays like those written by the authors you mentioned, as well as many others that were contemporary and current and, you know, cutting edge in many ways, but nobody was doing those because you had few theaters. First of all, anyway, you had some community theaters and you had some college theaters, and even they weren't necessarily doing those. They were doing a wide range of things, everything from Greek tragedy on up. But there wasn't a real concentration on what was happening, you know, now at that time. And we, you know, you could read these great reviews in the New Yorker or somewhere, and go, we'd love to not only see it, but, you know, play in it. So that was our vision, was somebody's got to do it, so we're just going to see what happens. And we wanted to produce contemporary, whether it was American or British or from wherever, something, but concentrating on those two English language ones. And that's where we had our start. And apparently that kind of, we get credit still, I think, for being the one that started that kind of thing, because then after that came Man Bites Dog.
You predate Man Bites Dog.
About four or 5 years, So I think it was okay, and I think people realized there is an audience for that.
Yeah.
Not as huge as, you know, the big musical or the standard comedies, but there was an audience as the Triangle was growing, so it kind of went hand in hand. And so that I was proud to see that REP lasted for 30 years, and like many other theaters, for whatever reasons, the finances or the changing of hands, you know, that ended a few years ago. But we, I think, made a difference. I'm proud of that.
One of my favorite lines was about the rock band, the Velvet Underground, from back in the late 60s, Lou Reed's band. Someone said only 10,000 people bought Velvet Underground records, but all of them went out and formed bands, you know, so the influence spread spread in that way. And I imagine that's true of REP's influence as well. What how do you see the Triangle Theater scene today? That's a pretty broad question, but
you know, well, I'm happy to see that it is thriving from my standpoint. I realize there's a lot of other issues about finances and you know, competition, but from just purely the theater critic and or audience aspect, you've got this huge banquet of choices. I've been trying to keep up with the number of theaters that are in the Triangle that are ongoing and that have at least some sort of announced season or have, you know, regular consistent productions. Yeah, yeah. And the number keeps changing practically daily, but at the moment it's around 55. And amazing. That always shocks people. But and that's not including anything that's public schools like high schools, and it's not children's theaters, but for what I would call regular full adult or, you know, general theaters. That includes professional touring things, professional locally based theaters, independent theaters like Burning Coal, community theaters, and college and university theaters. When you put all those together, you've got a current amount that's well over 50. And as I say, it literally changes daily. I keep finding new names that I don't know about on some, you know, list or something on Facebook, and it's just like, wow. Of course, I think the problem is that there's always going to be a level at which you can only support so many of these, and I think that's why things get winnowed out, of course. But I say more power to them. I mean, it's great if they can find a niche so that they can differentiate themselves from the next theater down the road, because obviously too many of the same thing means you're asking for a lot of support from ticket sales or donations. That's going to spread it thin.
Yep.
But I'm thrilled that there's so much variety. When I travel to other cities of, I would say, comparable size to the Triangle, and by the way, the Triangle is one city. You know, you've got Raleigh and Chapel Hill and Cary and Durham and other cities, but it's one unit. And I think that's what kind of fooled some people, because if you take the government, federal government's categorization of it, and that's where people live, work, and play, and they go in towards something. And if you take that perimeter, you've got 2.1 million people in the Triangle.
Yeah.
And so that's not an insubstantial number. Nope. And it's just like any other large city. But if you take St. Louis or Milwaukee or something like that, Nashville, you've got one name, and it seems like it's one bigger
people
unit.
People think of it as one city.
We're equally large and have that kind of population. And we happen to have a sort of, you know, well-educated, fairly wealthy, widely diverse population. So to me, it's not something where we have to say, oh, we wish we could be like some other city. You know, if you take out the top 10, if you want to, and even then I'm not so sure you can't make the comparison, but if you're not talking about New York, Los Angeles, you know, Chicago, and those, Philadelphia, those biggest things, we don't have anything to be, you know, shy about promoting ourselves as a theater town. It just happens to be a number of several counties.
Yeah, so there's that idea again, though. If you're playing to 100 people in Raleigh or playing to 100 people in New York, what difference does it make, really? Are we saying that the 100 people in New York are somehow more important than the people in Raleigh? I don't believe that's true. Talk to me a little bit about public subsidy for the arts. That's something you've seen ebb and flow over the time you've been in this business,
I imagine. I don't know that I'm much of an expert in that, because I don't get involved in it as far as having to apply, at least I'm not anymore after REP. Right. But certainly it's a terrible thing, because you have to constantly be scrambling for that, as you know. And there are all kinds of different plans and new ideas about trying to get that. Mm-hmm. And of course, you're always fighting the age-old problem of, are the arts, you know, equally worth the things you do for social subsistence and things. And so it's always something you have to prove to some people. But I think currently, because the wide variety of what's staged and produced here, that there's more, it's more easy, it, what's the right word? It's easier to give proof to the funders that these theaters are, you don't want to say making a difference. It isn't always about making some giant social change, but it's the productions that are being offered by almost every theater has risen up to this level of
quality
material that makes the audience take away something. It doesn't have to be anything major. It doesn't have to be some earth-shattering, mind-blowing thing. But if you come just for entertainment, you know, the theater can't do that anymore because it's everywhere. You do it on your phone and on your iPad and sitting in front of your TV. There's too many choices for entertainment that people are going to have cheaper and easier to get to. So you've got to have a reason that the theater should draw them out. And I'm hoping that that's because there is this, not only the immediacy of the connection you get when you're in the audience, but I'm pleased to see that the offerings by virtually all the theaters are things that, to me, are unique in their ability to entertain, but also let the audience think about things or at least take away something that gives them some insight into their lives, into the world, into what's going on. So I think that that's easier to prove. Again, whether there's money out there for it or not is always going to change with whoever the funders are. I know you're aware of the new thing that's being tried by Bear Theater and by Little Green Pig, which is to, I say new to them, new to sort of funding around here, in which they're trying to do the it's not just a Kickstarter thing where you get money for one production and then you go back and you start getting money for another. But this is asking for the old world thing of patronage, of where you give money because you like the theater's offerings and you give it for the whole season and long term, and you know you get tickets for it and you get privileges and whatever they can add to make it you know, sweeten the pot. But I mean, that's, you know, it seems to be working from the early returns. And very so good. That's something that will need to be watched to see if this is the way. I mean, that's the way some people who do the funding have always said, oh, you should be getting your own constituents to help you. We shouldn't be funding you. That's sort of the more conservative side of things, of we should be using this money for something else. So, you know, maybe that's the way to say, okay, let's try it.
But they wouldn't say, my son or my daughter goes to Broughton, so I shouldn't have to fund Inlow. You know, that argument only goes so far, it seems to me.
Well, that's the whole thing about the, you know, that somehow the arts are not equal to the other functions and needs that we supply money for.
And my answer to that is, people have been doing what I do for a living for 4,000 years. How about what you do? You know, to the fan of
good answer,
baseball or something like that, which I love, by the way. But but I suspect that 4,000 years from now, people will not be playing baseball. But I suspect they will be doing theater. Roy, you've talked about your work in other art forms as a critic. Tell me a little bit about that. You have a long-standing interest in music and the dance world as well. You have a lot of opportunity to immerse yourself in both of those forms here. Tell me a little bit about your interest there and where it leads you.
Well, it sort of grew out of, I think, the whole theatrical interest that took me to East Carolina and get the degree. And it was there that, because it was a, you know, a thriving university that had all sorts of other departments that put on concerts and productions, and they had series that brought in the finest, you know, performers in all those categories. And as a theater major, I mean, I took my dance classes, you know, my two ballet classes, which I'm glad there's no video of. And
That was tap for me.
Yeah, there
was
go.
One guy.
And, you know, you were expected to know about these things. And also just from an early age, I was always drawn to classical music. I learned to appreciate dance in college because I had friends in the theater community who were also dancers, you know, as that part of the theater team, and through them learn to see through their eyes. They would, in a sense, train me and tell me what, you know, what's good, what's bad, what you look for, and I'm glad I got that sort of background. So I've taken all that with me. So it's all been avocational. I have no training, formal training in either music or dance. I did do some, had some vocal lessons, and I sang in the choirs in college. But other than that, I've had no formal training in those, whereas I, you know, obviously my theater training is the more solid core. But that's an interesting point, because the actual call that came to ask me if I would start writing for the News Observer was to do classical music reviewing because they didn't have any at the time. But it was funny because when I got the call, they said, "We're interested in having you do reviews." And I said, "Oh, great, theater." They said, "Well, no." And then I thought, "Well, let's see, library." "Oh, books, review." "No." I said, "What? classical music?" And I said, "You've got to be kidding." I mean, it really was like aghast and disappointed, thinking, dang. I said, why aren't you calling, you know, the music professor at State University, or why aren't you calling on a private instructor?" And they had a great answer, which was, "You're not writing for a music journal or an academic journal. Mm-hmm. You're writing for the general public, general public. We don't want you to write in any way that has to be the sort of detailed insider thing. This has to be for the general reader." And that sort of convinced me. And I said, "Well, I'll take it on the condition that the first time somebody writes me a letter and says, 'Who let this, you know, know nothing on the paper that I quit?'" Luckily, there were several years before that happened. It got me in. And then from there, as I said, they eventually needed me for dance and then theater. So.
Not to end on a down note, but we have seen in the 21st century the loss of several significant theaters in the state. We lost, is it Blowing Rock or Flat Rock? One of the two up in the mountains. One of the two of them stopped as a producing entity. The venue is still there and it's still very active, but the producing institution is no longer here. The Shakespeare Festival out of High Point and Charlotte Rep, which was arguably the biggest professional theater in the state, is now gone and hasn't, it seems to me, been replaced.
Not I'm aware of.
How do you justify that, given all the growth, or how do you explain that population wise?
And I think it's like everything else, from politics on up, that, you know, it's not a single thing. You can't just say, "Oh, it's because there's not enough audience," or "They didn't manage it right," or "It's, you know, they're doing the wrong kinds of materials." I don't think there's an answer, because it really depends on each individual situation. Mm-hmm. It's always disappointing. And what I see, though, is there always is something to kind of take its place. Not directly, as you say, there's no direct replacement for the Charlotte Rep.
Right.
But I don't think I have any further insight into that, except knowing the background of some of them, including REP and certainly Deep Dish. The circumstances of the moment that, for whatever reason, I mean, Deep Dish didn't want to stop, but there seemed to be, at that moment, no place for them to go that would work.
No physical
place
available,
everything. So I think it's just a matter of, it's ever evolving, and, you know, there's going to be something that will change or stop. You know, we're not as bad as restaurants. Those go in and out
every 5 years,
5 weeks or so. Yeah. It's part of the game, I think.
Yeah. I guess so. Everything has a life cycle.
Yeah.
One would hope that that the professional model would not be taking such a significant hit as it has. Those first three that I mentioned were opportunities for professional artists to work in our state, and that's the loss that I am most concerned about. I'm not sure what the answer is either, but it's worrisome to me, and I don't see that trend in other cities, particularly to the north. What are you excited about going forward? I know, as a theater critic, you may not want to answer that question directly, but...
I certainly am still amassing the seasons for the theaters. Most have announced now, but I have a few lists. So we do a fall preview each year for the News Observer that looks at what's coming. I think, rather than, you know, indicating any particular theater or production, the thing that I see in general is, again, back to one of my other answers, is that there continues to be a broad range of material that's just not in the most popular, most easily accessed area. Nothing wrong with those in general, except, as I said, I think that's almost something you really can't do much anymore, because it's too similar to what people can get easily. But sort of looking, all the theaters seem to be looking for things that are unusual, haven't been seen, maybe has some sort of element that isn't what the sort of normal theater experience is. I mean, you know, Raleigh Little Theater did Beer Town recently, right, which is a very audience participation, changing every night kind of production. Mm-hmm. Things like that, I'm glad to see breaking out of the sort of normal pattern, and looking for different venues for things to be in. You know, it's nothing wrong with a theater with seats and, mm-hmm. and a stage, but the fact that that theater can be and has always been produced in, you know, the street corner or the outdoors. And so I like all of that. I think, you know, we've got some new aspects coming along. We've got a new head of the Playmakers coming in.
Yes, Vivian Banesh.
Vivian. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how that affects things as we go forward. Maybe the first season isn't, you know, the one to judge, but right. Definitely she'll be.
Because she didn't pick that first season.
She didn't pick all of that. I think that she had some influence on it. But, so there are things like that. You know, there's always something to kind of look forward to. And I'm pleased to see that there are certain, many of the theaters are trying to make sure that they are all inclusive and that they include, mm-hmm. you know, racial, sexual orientation, mm-hmm. political, whatever it is, they're broadening out. So it's not just one kind of narrow band of what you could say was, you know, in some cases, the sort of core theater
standards,
materials, and production. So I mean, I continue to look forward to the broadening of all of that.
It has gotten to the point where it almost seems like a really well-made play stands out as a unique
true
thing.
That's true. I mean, again, nothing, I'm glad that you can revive those, and the idea that too, you take something that is well known but decide to do something that either connects it to our current situation or shows in a different light, because if it's well known and everybody in the world has seen it, then you have to me, a more permission to do something pretty radical with it, because you aren't, there's always going to be somebody who's never seen it before. Sure. But if you're taking something that's too new and is considered some great thing, you don't want to play with it for too long so that the power of the original is there.
But still maintained.
A 70-year-old play like Glass Menagerie or All My Sons, you know, those can be re-examined.
Both of which are on right now.
That's true.
REP and Theater Raleigh, respectively. Roy, thank you very much for all you do for our community and for coming in today for the interview.
Thanks a lot, Jerry.
Okay, take care.